This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be cleaning you out for some new delight. The dark, malicious thoughts, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whomever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. So Rumi's guest house sets us up for an open door policy here, for a very potentially reactive series. If we take an intention in this series to allow the shadow to be seen, then quite likely the shadow will come at you. It already is. You'll just become more and more conscious of it. And I want to sort of hedge my talk with Jack Kornfield's warning a few years ago when I was talking about doing a series on this. He said, you know, there's a lot of psychic energy that's pent up in each one of us. And if you go into that topic, we don't know what's going to erupt. And I said, well, that's okay. As long as I know it to be safe and can teach it in that format and provide a tool, the insight meditation, for being able to work with it in a constructive and positive manner, then from my point of view, let's go into it. Let's do it. That's why I offered the caveat to those of you who are just coming in off the street that this is not the series you want to come in off the street on. You need to have the background way to be able to hold your emotional life, your internal world, to make this a constructive series. So I offer you that. As an introduction, Carl Jung said, one does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. Now, when we talk about the shadow, we're talking about the powers of darkness that have been personified through our movies as Dracula and vampire and werewolves and on and on. But the cinema that I think most represents the fear we have is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Because we all want to be the Dr. Jekyll of our era. The sophisticated, respected person handling and proficient in his profession. But we all fear that there may be a Mr. Hyde back in there somewhere. And the tension that we have in trying to maintain that sense of division between ourselves keeps us in the grips of that very Mr. Hyde. It keeps us reactionary, keeps us judgmental. It keeps us fearful. And we really are forced at some point to acknowledge this, because the practice of meditation is the practice of releasing that worry, releasing the tension, letting go of the fear we have of this inward division inside of us. And if there is a great deal of fear in that division, within that, embodied within that division, then letting go is going to be the most difficult thing we've ever tried to do, because why would we let go when Mr. Hyde is on the other end of that release? And we fear, I think, that the darkest elements within us, and we perhaps have caught glimpses of those elements in our dreams or even in the eruptions into our conscious psyche, of what that might contain, what Mr. Hyde is back in there. And it doesn't give us a great deal of safety in that. We don't feel necessarily secure in what we have seen. In fact, we think that if we ever let go of the tension between Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, that we would become more like an animal, out of control, as Mr. Hyde was. At the whim of our passions, our rage, our terror, and we'd have no way to keep that at bay, to keep Mr. or Dr. Jekyll in control. And so there's a tremendous psychic, internal psychic bond that we have for one and against the other. This inherent conflict is at the heart of our suffering. I hope people can begin to understand that as we go through these series. We're going to take this subject apart. We're going to take it out and we're going to just look at every aspect of it. Now, I want to offer you some sense of safety in the direction. A friend of mine, a somewhat psychic individual in Kansas City, was listening to one of my tapes over the internet, and her five-year-old son, who has never met me, started listening to the tape. And he approaches his mother and he says, who is that? And she explained that I was a meditation teacher. And he says, he asked for some crayons and some paper because he was going to draw me. So he sets out and he draws this picture and he takes it to his mother. And his mother doesn't really understand what the stick figures are, and there's some kind of light or something, and there's looks like a cave. So his mother asks the five-year-old to explain the drawing. And the five-year-old said, this stick figure that's coming out of the cave, that's the man who's speaking. He's come out to get his flashlight so he can lead the rest of us to discover the cave. Now, he doesn't know my props, which... So I thought that that was a pretty good description of what we are going to be doing in this journey in the next few weeks together. I feel very safe in this subject. I feel very confident because I understand what we're looking at. And so I hold out the flashlight and a direction for us all to go into this together. But I can't... It is not my job to force you into the cave. You have to feel ready to go into this. You have to feel that you want to do it, first of all, that you have the intention to start uncovering some of these darker areas in ourselves. And then we can journey together. So you can treat these series in many different ways. You can treat it as a journey into yourself, or you can treat it as a potential of something you might want to do in the future. And this is not a series in which I'm going to encourage you beyond your normal disposition to come. So you should know that going in. So, but we also must realize that in order to be free, we have to go into the shadow. We cannot skirt it. We cannot shun it. We cannot avoid it. We have to go in and understand this thing. Now, I want to point us back to a previous series last year of the five aggregates, when we took apart the mind and began to understand that virtually everything that we held in terms of our fear was a projection from the mind's own disposition, from its own explanation, and that nothing in itself was fearful except through conveyance of that projection, that anticipation. And if we are willing to look at it, and just begin to bring the conscious attention to it, as Rumi says in his guest house, then we'll find what that five aggregate series was pointing to is that there is essential emptiness there. And that what we are withdrawing from or reacting to is the projection, our mental projection, that it is something other than emptiness. Inherently, the subject does not contain anything substantial. It is only our ability to create something out of nothing that makes it as fearful of an object as it is. So what is then the orientation to this whole series, but the orientation that we should have already developed through the course of the meditation, which is to allow, or may I put it this way, relax, observe, and allow. Relax, observe, and allow. And those are the very tools which decompose the substance the mind gives to something into the insubstantial, empty quality that is inherently its nature. So we already have the tool to do that. We need not bring any more skillful means to us than what we already have available. Okay. So shadow formation. I have to say this. I love reading about it. Anybody that's spent some time by the deathbed is well aware of the shadow, because as somebody dies, they are unable to maintain the division, the neat Dr. Jekyll division with Mr. Hyde. It all starts getting folded in there, coming out in terms of eruption of the psyche or in terms of dreams. Because I'm used to sitting by the bedside of the people who are dying, it also brings up, of course, one's own reactions to what you see. I have to say that it was one of the reasons that I was most interested in working with the dying, is to see what came out of the mind at that crucial moment. It's in there. It's been invited in through our learning process. It's not a given for an individual. It's a learning through communication, through a variety of verbal and nonverbal responses. We have been taught that part of ourselves is okay and part of ourselves is not. The problem is that when we're taught that, we don't have the discernibility of what it is that's teaching us. It's the adult world, and the adult world holds all the empowerment. And the adult world then begins to say things to us like, what will you be when you grow up? Which means, essentially, you're nothing now. You'll only be something when you're an adult. So already, you're at a loss at whatever age you're asked that question. And then we're given and intoned with a constant variety of both social and interpersonal directives, and, you know, to be strong, big boys don't cry, I never want to hear you say that again, don't touch that place on your body, right? We don't act like that in this family. Right? We don't say those things. So what's the message we get? In fact, we are being shaped by being invalidated. We're as shaped as much through invalidation as we are through reward. In fact, when we shape through reward, we're also shaping through invalidation. Because when you reward a certain quality in somebody, you're saying exactly the same thing about the opposite. Inversely. And so the adult projects their own sense of inward discomfort and teaches the child that discomfort as he or she grows, instills it in us, so that the shadow shapes others to be in its own likeness. Generation after generation after generation. We don't even know we're doing it. The child is taught to disown what we have long since learned to disown in ourselves. So the child must fit in a mature adult's ideal of appropriate play. And immaturity is negated. And because it's negated through invalidation, it's never really examined. As an adult, when we receive feedback that causes pain and some sense of self-inadequacy, at least we have the skills to be able to look at that, to recover ourselves from that experience, some of us. And therefore, we can examine that behavior and that particular immature emotional reaction or whatever it is that we were condemned for. We can look at it. We can bring it up to maturity. But if you're just condemned at a small age, you have no resources to examine that. And so it remains calcified within us as an unacceptable, disowned, invalidated component. Disidentify. To live up for adult, to live up in equivalent to the adult expectation. And if Dharma practice is about anything, it's about being whole and complete. And at a very young age, we learn how to give up that sense of wholeness and completion for acceptance. That's what we get in return. We get the nod or the approval. And then that allows us to be forever at the disposition of that which is external. Because we've given up the wholeness of completion within ourselves for the sake of acceptance and the division between that which is not acceptable in me and my attempt to build and maintain acceptance in the population at large. So inherently there becomes a sense of me that's formed. A sense of me that looks for the reinforcement in terms of acceptance externally and denies and holds and shields the internal unaccepting part. That tension that is created through those two halves rubbing together endlessly. And this series is going to show you how endless it is. It's endless in the simple and immediate judgment of something. It's present in the and the statement of who you are and the image of who you think you are. That tension is inherent in that. And to fill this void of incompletion that we gave up, we now feel incomplete. To fill the void that we no longer feel complete and whole. What we attempt to do is to act through will and direct the sense of completion towards external sources, not only acceptances, but in my desires. And so real, full-hearted wholeness of spirit, of mind, of body, when it gets percolated through the divisiveness of the shadow, then becomes a dependency upon external world for that completion, because it can no longer turn inwardly for its sense of wholeness. And when it does that, it looks longingly for things or people or anything that it needs, what it thinks it needs in order to be complete. That's what desire is. It's an attempt towards finding completion. But in so doing, we create forever the division of inward and outward. And it feeds the flames of our own suffering to look in that direction. And so this moment is never arrived, is never satisfied for its own sense, because its own sense is that I'm incomplete. Why would I want to rest in my incompletion? I need to proceed into the future where I can be complete, where I can bring forth the ingredients that my mind thinks it needs in order for completion to be satisfied. And so desire and desire and desire keeps manifesting itself, only to lead to frustration after frustration after frustration. You know, I have a shaman friend. And I was visiting her in Santa Fe a few years ago. And I was just asking what she does. And she says, well, you know, she's an amazing woman. And she wrote a book called Soul Retrieval. And she actually did some of this with me. But she lies down beside you and she listens to certain drum beats. And then she travels in a certain astral plane and finds parts of you that has been cut off from yourself. And often these parts have been captured by others' entities. I don't know. No, this is like way out there. I have no experiential knowledge of this whatsoever. But I do have a lot of admiration for the person who was telling me. And she seems to know what she was talking about. And what she does is she travels in that astral plane and somehow through her trickery gets those parts back from the other entities and brings them back to the person who she's doing the soul retrieval for. Now, so she did this for me. And I went home and I said to her, before I left, I said to her, you know, I don't feel anything. I just want to be honest. I don't feel any different. So I think you failed. So anyway, I went home and she said, well, you're not supposed to feel anything right now. So I thought, okay, well, I'll let you know if I do. So after about a week or two, there was just this sense of having landed in a way that I never had, having been grounded just with my feet to the earth, just together in some way. And I wrote her and she said that was a perfect experience that we would hope that people would have who have gone through this. I don't know. I don't know how psychically all that stuff works. I don't know how we retrieve parts of ourselves. But I do know how we keep things distant from us through our unacceptance. And I do know that those entities, whoever captured those parts, cannot withstand our heart's desire and intention for inclusion and wholeness and our willingness to go through the pain of that division in order to get there. That I am sure. We don't need somebody to soul retrieve for us. We need the courage to look at these areas of ourselves that have been molested, and that's not too small of a word, and ripped from our psyche. Not through a malicious culture, not intentionally malicious. It is malicious, but it's not intentionally so. It's for because of ignorance, because people don't understand what they're doing to one another. And you can see it, you know, in some of the fundamental religions that are available. And I'm talking about fundamentalism across the specter of religions. There are fundamental Buddhists that are as obnoxious as any fundamentalism. That sense of righteousness. And that righteousness is so divisive that even though, and I'm now just going to talk about Christianity because that's the fundamentalism that I most understand with my, I have a brother who's one, that even though the symbol for me of Christianity is Christ holding his arms out saying, everyone come, all inclusive, this is an all inclusive thing, everyone come, all things come, which is an enormous psychic statement of wholeness. That in that divisive understanding of Christianity, where we have the right to go to war, onward Christian soldiers, and death penalty, you know, people should die for, you know, and welfare, you know, those views are from the divisiveness of the way, the view that we hold the tradition. St. Paul said, for the good that I would do, I do not. But for the evil which I would not, that I do. See, I love that. See, he understands the shadow. And the mechanism which divisiveness in spirituality and in religion, the mechanism that they hold to heal that rift exacerbates that rift because it's moralistic. Further division. Moralism. The good. You see, the way you promote God is to fight the devil. Feel the tension in that. Who wants to live in a world like that? I'd rather just go sign myself over to the devil. Everything by the book, everything in line, everything, you know, black and white. It's not like that. This war of good and evil creates the very division we war against. We don't even really, it's the cat chasing its own tail. We don't even see it. And evil, then, is avoided at all cost, but never extinguished. It lingers. In fact, the more charge, the more resolved we are in being good, the more unlikely it is that that will be true. Wholeness requires giving up God's protection. Jesus said in the Gospel of St. Thomas, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will free you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. Someone said, our shadow is created by standing in our own sunlight. Nothing can be eliminated in the mind. Let us be very clear. As a principle of the mind, we have to be very clear of the principles. That nothing can be eliminated in the mind through force of will. It doesn't work like that. It just creates further divisiveness, further shadow, more tension, more conflict. I think if we really understood that, this practice would be remarkably easy. We still think we have to protect ourselves from this stuff. We still think that what we have to do is to resist, never realizing that the person who is resisting is also a mental component of the mind. So it's the mind divided against itself in contention. The person is not outside the mind, the owner of the mind. They're in the mind. The sense of me is in the mind. So it's just one component of the mind antagonistically against another, a mind divided against itself. So that shadow, that dark and forbidden component of ourselves, created through inward tyranny. Whenever we say, I am this way, we have a shadow. Whenever we take a stand in some quality or facet of ourselves, we have by definition created its opposite, which is equally as true as the persona that we willfully hold. I'm strong. I'm courageous. I'm smart. I'm whatever. Because the continuum of mental factors, all mental factors are a continuum. There's no way that one can lay claim to any point on the continuum. We're all of it. At any particular moment, we'll have rage and this and that. Nothing will come into the beautiful landscape that we pretend in our ideal symmetry of me. It doesn't work like that. So we have to understand the basic principles of how the mind works. And then we can begin to understand how to work with a shadow. If we don't have those basics down, we will forever be creating points on that, like a televangelist, crying for morality, and inwardly seething with its opposite. We can't get rid of anything in ourselves. We can't do it. So then what are the options? If you know, I had a friend, I think I probably have told this story, but it's such a good one that it's worth telling again. She was in a traffic jam with her 5 kids in a station wagon, and each child had to be somewhere, and she was late for every one of them. And she was in a traffic jam, and she was just like dead stop on some highway. And they were all screaming and playing and poking, and her mind was going crazy. And suddenly, insight, being what it is, she says, I will be in this station wagon forever. In the moment she said that, there was no problem. I mean, she really said it. Not like, God, I'm going to be in this station wagon forever. But that's the fact. This is going to be forever. So that's it. And she immediately relaxed within that. Now, it took on a workable solution. As long as there was the tension between the five children and where I was going and what I had to do and what I wasn't doing and how I wasn't being a good mother, and then it was forever lost within that. The drive was miserable. This is directly related to how we work with our minds. This is the situation, whatever might be flowering. This is the station wagon of our life. We cannot rearrange it. Five kids and a nagging idealism. It's the fact that we think we can. We can shove one of the children out. It just doesn't work. You can't get rid of a thing. Listen to this, please. You can't get rid of a thing. That's it. Period. It has to be absolute. If I give you an eighth of an inch, then heaven and hell is infinitely far apart, and you've got the devil. Wherever we stand, whatever is occurring, let us relax. Let us, okay, that can be felt. You see, we haven't been trying to make you feel good. This isn't humanistic psychology, which is, okay, I'm going to feel really good about myself. This is how you get through the experience of pain and become free. This is how you manage yourself to freedom. This is the indication. This is the direction. This isn't religious moralism. This is something far deeper and richer that's available if we learn how the mind works from understanding. Now I can work with this thing. I understand what this whole thing, how this works. I can understand now. And how the mind is set to make something out of nothing again and again and again. It just wants to land on the continuum and claim ownership, because then it can be known through that ownership as being bright and courageous and humble and whatever else we wish for ourselves. We love to take a stand on those continuums. We want to personify what the world wants from us, because we have learned that acceptance is how I become validated. You see how we have to be stronger than this? We have to be more courageous than that. We have to be deeper and more insightful. Not just take it for, okay, you know, this is really going to test every inch of our courage, of our understanding, of our wisdom. See, a mind state arises insubstantially, but then we bring forth the resistance to it, which is essentially saying, I disown you. Historically, I've seen how this thing plays out. I disown you. And so we make something from absolutely nothing. Out of fear of it, we create its substantiality, its meaning, and we bind ourselves to the mind state through the meaning that we have interpreted because we're afraid of it. What if we just open to it? What if we just let down our guard? It would fall back. See, it can't maintain either its binding force of aversion nor its belief system, when we face it head on. It can't maintain it. The fear can only maintain its meaning through our fear. Release the resistance, and it falls back in on itself and implodes back in into being insubstantial. Fear would have you believe otherwise. And fear is the reason the shadow has become the Dracula of our time. We've created we have bats and everything is... We've really written a very rich coloring book. None of it real. None of it substantial. That's why I can lead you with a flashlight into the cave. Because I don't care what you bring forth. If you'll sit with me with it, if you'll sit together with it, we can prove its insubstantiality. But when we're afraid, you see, surrender when you're afraid. When we're afraid, there are two types of surrender. One is the complete release of resistance. The other, out of fear, is the surrender to the shadow, which usually means surrender to someone else who must know more than I. And you know what we do? We surrender to their shadow. Now they're in control. And God help us when that happens. Our hero worshiping is all shadow. Our patriotism is all shadow. All shadow. Our sense of American citizen, all shadow. That's why in Dharma we talk about inclusivity. Everything, no matter what, inclusive. Nothing is left out. Nothing. Joseph once said in one of his courses, Joseph Goldstein, he said if he put a projector behind him and could project his mind onto that screen and show it to the people who were coming to the course, everyone would leave. It's true for every one of us. I don't know what you project onto me, but you shouldn't see inside this thing. But it doesn't make any difference. It's how we relate to it. It's not that it's arising. It's how we relate to it. You know, I had a dream when I thought I was going to give the shadows talk, right? So I tell you, when you put the intention there, it starts coming at you. So I was thinking about the shadow. So I went to sleep and I had a dream in which I cut off somebody's head, mutilated them. And I woke up just like, I couldn't believe, I said, this isn't really me, this was a dream. See how I was trying to escape? Listen to the escape I was using. That's it. See, I was unwilling to own the mind state of mutilation. So just listen. Well, thank God that was a dream and it wasn't me, you know. It was symbolism. Okay, so what was symbolic about that, you see? So all the ways I could wiggle from the mind state itself. So I wouldn't have to own it. So I wouldn't have to take responsibility for this mind state. Cutting off somebody's head with a knife. A Dharma teacher. No, you just, okay, so that's it. Mutilate, okay, so that too. See, it doesn't mean that we become it, that we act it out. That's due to the resistance from it. When we identify with something and we resist the identification, you're going to play it out. It's got to happen. But in allowing it, nothing has to be played out. There's something in wholeness of mind. It sees things, but it also sees things in the arena of wholeness. It doesn't get lost in some kind of animal way. It doesn't lose its basic goodness. Basic goodness is inherent to wholeness. It's not a statement of good versus bad. It's everything together. That's a very different statement than moralism, which pits one against the other. And one of the things that drives me very strongly in this direction is my intuitive sense that when we die, the barricades come down. We're no longer in the body. And the mind just runs. And it runs in whatever direction, in whatever way, it runs. An unedited film. It doesn't have the ability to edit anymore. In fact, if you read Tibetan Book of the Dead, one of the ways that you work with the dying over these bardo states is to keep reinforcing to the person who has died, to the mind that has died, that it is dead, that the states and the fear states and the terror states and the whatever states that are arising within the mind because it's unabridged are insubstantial, are empty. Well, I don't want to wait then, till then. I want to find out the insubstantiality now. So let's look at this thing. And then when that happens, it'll take care of itself through the understanding that will also be part of that mental unfolding. So we have to welcome this topic. We have to come into it. It's not an easy one. But literally, our spiritual lives depend upon it. So I welcome us to this topic together. Together. We're going in together. We're going into the cave together. I'll hold a light as brightly as I can. And together we'll search this thing out and put it in. Thank you. So if we could sit for a minute or two. So if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to. I don't know what you mean by operations of resistance.
You know, you say when we don't open to whatever, a feeling, automatically resistance arises.
Yes. It's fear. Resistance is fear. Resistance is not is protection.
From
what we think that thing is. We think that it's something that it isn't. We have made something out of it that it is doesn't inherently contain. So we project. Did you come to the series of the five aggregates? We project the mind into things. That's what the world is to us. Nothing that we see is what we think it is. I mean, it is what we think it is. It's not what it is. It's what we think it is. So everything is coated with the substance that we give it. So when we come, and that's also true of our inward world. So anger is not just that. It's what my father did to me and how he lost himself in rage and the countless times that I have been lost myself in anger and on and on and on. It's the history applied to a mind state. And so then what we do is get afraid of the history. We get afraid of what we know about it, which is history. And so then we resist the history that we have given it. That's how ridiculous this is that it's all self-created. Do you understand? You see the absurdity of it? Well, you have to actually see it. Then when you see it, you'll think, this is so absurd. Well, I'm not doing this anymore. But that is, in fact, what has happened. And that's what happens internally to us as well. What is the world? You see, we took it apart in those five aggregates. We really looked. It's nothing. But what we say it is, that's what it is. That's its sum total. And when the Buddha said the world is created within this fathom-long body, he meant literally, not figuratively. And so we can deconstruct it because we constructed it. If it were outside of us and not our doing, then there would be no hope. There would be heaven and there would be hell, and there would be God and there would be devil. And I'll go to that camp and avoid that camp. And it would all be a given. But the fact is that it's not. Because it's internally disposed, we then have the ability to recover the original. So you have. I think that's a very important question to ask. When you're understanding, you will be a therapist that's directly proportional to your understanding. And if you taught that, or you therapeute, whatever the word is, if you're a therapist, and then your understanding is going to be what governs that therapy. That's as simple as that. It's going to govern everything, but it's going to govern the therapy and how you understand other people's mind. But as you begin to grow, your therapy will also grow, hopefully. And as that happens, then there's certain things that you can't do anymore because you see you've recovered that data in yourself, and you can't, then it doesn't work anymore. And so the more conscious you become, the more you allow other people not to hold. See, your shadow tries to maintain their shadow. And it's unconscious in you, and it's unconscious in them. And the less you're conscious, the more that shadow seeks its own likeness. And so you'll keep the person in their history, which is shadow. But the more conscious you become, the less that has meaning to you, the more you'll bring them forth to the present, to stand in the present, free of all of that.
I'll be at the job, but
you won't be out of a job. You'll be sought after beyond your belief. Because people know the taste of that, and they seek out that. They seek you out. You don't ask for it, it comes. Yes.
I just want to be clear on one thing. Freedom isn't necessarily all sweetness and light and joy. It's just...
You mean the path to freedom, or do you mean freedom?
I mean freedom.
Freedom is all sweetness and light. Doesn't mean there isn't challenges, but there's no resistance, there's no suffering, there is unpleasantness, and there are challenges, but there's no suffering, if that's what you mean by sweetness and light. That means resistance to the challenges. That means separating yourself out from those challenges. What I say is abiding in God. You're abiding in the challenge, not the challenge isn't outside of you and you have to figure it out. You're abiding within it. It's manifesting at the same, it's all manifesting, and you're abiding in that manifestation. The path to freedom for most of us is full of ups and downs, full of trials and tribulations, full of Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker. It's full of all that stuff. That seems to be the journey that most of us have to take. And the shadow is one of those seemingly oppressive challenges that we all have to go through. We already have gone through a lot of it. This series, by and large, many of us have gone well into this, well into the cave. We're way back in there, you know. Because we've been doing it. You can't have opened in this practice for a substantial period of time without the shadow having hit you in a variety of different ways. And you've been able to work with it, you know, open to it, you know, step back, be afraid, but then find, okay, recover yourself, open to it. And so we're already well back in there, right? But there are corners that we still refuse to go, most of us. There are still corners. I want to go into those corners. I want to go into the niches. That whole cave has to be flooded with light. Because anything of substance creates a shadow, by definition. Anything insubstantial does not create a shadow. Light goes through it. Light will go through emptiness, but it will be blocked by... So all we're doing by casting out the light onto the darkness is making it insubstantial, showing that it was... The truth of it was never that it was something to cast a shadow. Do you see? So we'll do that. We do this slowly. We do this step by step, patiently. Don't feel like you have to rush. No rushing. Patiently. Step by step. And we do it as a sangha. That's why we're going into this for 12 weeks. Plenty of time, you know. And now we have sort of an orientation to the subject, and we'll start looking at some of the corners in there. Yes?
I just want to know if many people are familiar with Plato and the cave. It's interesting that you use up the cave and Plato. It's the opposite way. We're already in a cave.
You're changing metaphors.
Pardon?
You're switching metaphors. Well, I just would stay with the metaphor. You're just switching metaphors. He used it as a different metaphor.
Okay.
So I'm using the cave as a different sense of metaphor, okay? Yeah.